Okay, so I'm going to be talking to you about HPV and a particularly, I think, important group to be considering here, which is men who have sex with men. And by way of disclosure, as you've heard, I've received research grant support and sit on advisory boards for Merck. So this is the transformation zone that Heidi showed you so nicely. And the reason I show this to you is to point out that the transformation zone in the cervix is the vulnerable part of the cervix, where we have two different kinds of epithelium meeting, the squamous epithelium of the exocervix and the columnar epithelium of the endocervix. And there is a similar area in the anal canal. The anus, in fact, is far more similar to the cervix than you might think from an anatomic standpoint, considering they're very different functions. And the transformation zone in the anus is here. It's the anorectal junction, where the squamous epithelium of the anus meets the columnar epithelium of the rectum. So just to be clear, whenever you see the word rectal in combination with HPV, it's a mistake. All right, the anus is the sole area here that is infectable by HPV. It only infects the squamous epithelium. So rectal cancer is a very different disease. It has nothing to do with HPV. We're talking very specifically about anal cancer. Now, since this is such a similar disease and a similar anatomy, we borrowed, up to 15 years ago or so, the same techniques that gynecologists have used to study cervical disease, namely doing anal pap smears, we call them tush paps. We do HPV testing, we do high-resolution anoscopy using a cervical colposcope with the vinegar that Heidi showed you, and we take biopsies to make treatment decisions, again showing very similar histopathology and a very similar rate of progression from infection to disease and cancer that Heidi showed you. So this is another version of what Heidi showed you, going from normal epithelium, and this is the cervix, through low-grade disease, ultimately high-grade disease, and if left alone, a high proportion of these patients will go on to invasive cancer. This is the very same kind of changes that you would see if you looked at the anus. And so this slide, in my opinion, is equally applicable to anal disease as it is to cervical. So just like in the cervix, this is the lesion that we're most worried about in the anus, the high-grade anal intraepithelial neoplasia, also known as AIN. So AIN2 and AIN3 are the primary targets of screening programs that are already in existence to try and remove those lesions before the progression to cancer can occur. So why is anal cancer important? Well, firstly, it's actually being discussed a little bit in the media these days. As most of you probably know, Farrah Fawcett died of anal cancer. Unfortunately, there was very little discussion about what the origin of that cancer was, and I was very sad for her, but I was also disappointed that it wasn't more of a teaching moment than I thought it could have been. But the cancer is actually increasing in the general population, in both men and women, in almost all of the developed countries where this has been looked at through national databases. Here in the US, the incidence of the cancer in both men and women is going up by about 2% per year. So it is a relatively rare cancer compared with cervical cancer, on the order of about 1/10 that in women. And it's even rarer in men. But the important thing to understand here is, as epidemiologists, you know that the denominator is everything. And in certain risk groups, such as MSM, we see a very, very different picture. So just to put this again into the context of cervical disease, before we had cervical cytology screening in the US, the incidence of cervical cancer was on the order of 40 to 50 per 100,000. Now it's down to about 8 to 10 per 100,000. But if you look at the incidence of anal cancer in men who have sex with men before the HIV epidemic, the incidence was estimated to be as high as 35 per 100,000, which is quite similar, I think, to this number, also in an unscreened population. So that's the situation with HIV negative individuals, and as you know, HIV positivity confers increased risk above and beyond that. And some of the early data prior to the advent of antiretroviral therapy showed that the incidence of anal cancer in HIV-positive men was 38-fold higher than in the general population of men, and that risk was particularly high in those who acquired HIV probably through anal intercourse, with a nearly 60-fold increase over the general population. The other interesting thing is that risk is not confined to men. And we see a nearly sevenfold increase in anal cancer in HIV-positive women compared with the general population of women. Now, these are the data before antiretroviral therapy became available. As you know, when ART came on the scene, we saw a dramatic reduction in many of the other HIV-associated cancers, Kaposi sarcoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We were hoping that we would see the same thing with the HPV-related cancers, but that has not actually happened. In fact, in the case of anal cancer, that rate has probably gone up since the introduction of ART. Why? Probably because we're dealing with a situation where people are living longer, they're not dying of other HIV-related causes, they have more time to develop a high-grade lesion and more time sitting there with a high-grade lesion unscreened and untreated. So it's kind of a perfect storm, since this is a lesion, as you heard, that can take a long time to go from high-grade disease to invasive cancer. So here are three reports that came out within the last year or so showing rates of cancer that we would consider utterly unacceptable for cervical cancer in this country. 75 per 100,000 person years in France, two reports from the US, 137 per 100,000, 78 per 100,000. These are not good numbers. I told you that we look for this lesion through high-resolution endoscopy, and this is just one example of the kind of thing we don't like to see. So here's somebody who's got a lesion in the anal canal. It looks a little bit funky, funny-looking vessels, but it was biopsied and just shown to be AIN3. And then about a year later, we see this, a big ulcerating lesion, which was obviously an invasive cancer. So I'm just going to zip through some of the next few slides by way of background, because these are published data. But what they essentially tell us is that if you're an MSM and you're HIV negative, you have a very high risk of anal HPV, about 60%. And if you're positive, you have virtually 100% risk of HPV infection. So everybody who's HIV positive and who's had anal intercourse has anal HPV infection. Almost everybody has a high-risk oncogenic HPV type as well. The interesting thing is that if you look at those HIV-negative MSM, who are numerically more abundant, obviously, than the HIV-positives, if you look at them over in a single-point prevalence study, but at a range of ages, we see a very different pattern from what you saw from Heidi. Remember, and I'll show you this in the next slide, we saw an age-related decline in the prevalence of HPV infection, commonest in the young women, most women clear by the age of 30. When we did this study in four cities around the United States where we did anal HPV testing in sexually active HIV negative MSM and anal pap smears, in fact, the prevalence of HPV stayed stable throughout that person's, well, throughout the age range from less than 25 to over 60 at a rate between 50 and 60%. So these numbers are very different from what Heidi showed you before. And you may say, ugh, that's frightening, and it is, but the other interesting thing is these numbers are quite similar to the data recently published of penile HPV infection in heterosexual men. So I think that this pattern is more of a male pattern rather than an anal pattern or a penile pattern, if you will. And we could discuss why we think it's different from the female pattern in the question and answer period. If you look at disease, again, we see very high rates of disease, not surprisingly. Here we see a clearer correlation between HIV status and lower CD4 levels. But even the HIV negative men have much higher rates of anal disease than healthy young women in the general population do. So in that same study that I mentioned to you before, between 18 and 25% of men had abnormal anal cytology throughout the age span here. And since anal cytology is only about 50% sensitive, we think that represents a true prevalence of disease of about 40% or so. So in fact, we looked at that. We did a population-based study in San Francisco, and we called people up using random digit dialing. We said, are you gay? Would you mind having something put up your butt? And it worked very nicely. That probably is one of my few only in San Francisco stories. But it was very revealing, in fact, because when you look at, that wasn't meant to be a joke, when you looked at the HIV positive participants, looking just at HPV infection, 88% had it, similar to our cohort studies, and 72% had an oncogenic HPV type. And when you look at the HIV negative participants, again, very similar to the data I showed you before, 57% of the HIV negative men and 34% had a high risk type. Now, if you look at disease, remember the AIN 2 to 3 is the one we're worried about. Overall, we found that 43% of the HIV positive participants had the high grade lesion, and 25% of the HIV negative participants had the high grade lesion. So this is a, I think, a really potentially serious public health issue, and in the worst case scenario, could be a significant time bomb. I alluded to the fact that anal cancer is also increased in women, and in this study, this was one of the first studies done of anal HPV infection in women. The surprising thing is that when you compared anal infection in yellow to cervical in teal, in every group that we've looked at, anal infection was more common than cervical infection. Now, this was a group of high-risk women here, risk matched to the HIV-positive women in this study. But we and others have done a number of studies in healthy young women, and we consistently show that anal infection is as common or more common than cervical infection, even in general population type studies. Of course, it's still about cancer and AIN, and in that study that I just showed you, not surprisingly, we found that AIN itself was about as common as CIN was, and in the HIV positive women, and in the HIV negative women, it was about the same, 4% versus 5% in the HIV negative women. So the infection is there, and it does cause disease. So I'd like to just spend the rest of my time talking about prevention, since this is the STD prevention conference. And as you've heard before, there's really two primary approaches to prevention here. The first is for people who've already acquired HPV, who've developed disease, to try and screen for and treat the lesions that have the potential to progress to cancer. And that's what I'm alluding to here, detection and treatment of AIN. And second is prevention of HPV infection itself through vaccination. So anal cancer, like cervical cancer, is an HPV-associated cancer, and probably the even higher proportion of the anal cancers are associated with the HPV types in the two commercially available vaccines. So probably about 80 to 90% of anal cancers are associated with HPV 16 and 18. And so if we can prevent infection with those types, then we have a significant possibility of preventing anal cancer. Now let's just talk a bit about the first approach, which is the diagnosis and treatment of high-grade disease. In order for this to make sense, we have to have some degree of comfort that high-grade disease is a true anal cancer precursor, just like it's been shown in the cervix. This has been a hard study to do because you really ought not to be following patients prospectively with high-grade disease to see if they develop anal cancer. This was done in New Zealand in the cervix and caused a great scandal. At any rate, for a number of reasons, we did have a bunch of patients who did not get treated for high-grade disease, and I put together a series of 22 patients who had a biopsy-proven high-grade lesion and who definitely developed anal cancer at the very same site where we had biopsied the high-grade lesion. Not surprisingly, this took some time. It was about 4 years or so, and most of the patients were asymptomatic. So we have absolutely no doubt that the high-grade lesions are cancer precursors, just like in the cervix. So based on that kind of thinking, we have recommended a screening and treatment program for at-risk individuals, which is very similar to the cervical program that you've heard about. One difference is we would probably include ascus in people who should be referred for high-resolution anoscopy because we find a high prevalence of AIN lesions in that group. If the person has nothing and they're HIV positive, cost-effectiveness studies show that it should be repeated in 12 months, and if you're HIV negative, every 2 to 3 years. So now this is the holy roller part of my talk because I come bearing good news. I want to present to you briefly some of the data that have come out from the Merck 20 protocol. This is the protocol of the quadrivalent vaccine given in a very similar dose regimen, this time to men. And I want to just explain that there were really two studies within this study. The first one, that we're calling the main study, had a combination population of 3,463 heterosexual men and 602 MSM. And the primary outcomes there were, it was external disease, external genital warts, intraepithelial neoplasia of the penis, perianal area, and perineum, and cancers from these areas. And then there was a sub-study which focused on all of these in the MSM, plus in the MSM, a focus on AIN, anal HPV infection, and anal cancer. So the study basically involved scraping of the perianal and external genital areas on everybody, and then for the MSM, in addition to that, anal pap smears and anal HPV testing. Now, it's important to understand in the data that I'm going to show you that these are relatively sexually inexperienced people, just like the women were in the female studies. So they had to have had no history of genital lesions, warts, and lifetime sexual partners. To get in as a heterosexual man, you had to have 5 or fewer partners. And the same was true of MSM, where it had to be a combination of 5 or fewer male or female partners. So you can imagine this was a challenging study to recruit to. I had probably the toughest time recruiting to this study I've ever had. We went to the San Francisco Gay Pride Parade with trinkets and, you know, shiny beads, and it didn't work. So I'm going to start off by telling you quickly about the external genital data first. Remember, these are the combo of the heterosexual men and the MSM, but I also want to point out that the results with the MSM, when you broke it down, were very similar to the population as a whole. So the important thing here is this is the per protocol population, meaning this is your ideal population, naive to that HPV type at baseline by virtue of being seronegative and DNA negative for that HPV type and fulfilling all the vaccine protocol criteria. And what we found was that for all of the vaccine HPV types, we saw excellent efficacy. This is persistent infection, which is the true predictor of disease. And we saw not only protection against 6 and 11, but good protection against HPV 16 and 18 as well. These were all statistically significant. And then as a disease endpoint, the external genital lesions, if you looked at external genital lesions due to any HPV type, we saw 81% efficacy. Specifically for those external genital lesions related to the vaccine types, which is where you expect your highest efficacy, we saw 90% reduction in those lesions. So this is really great news. Now the only problem is, as you might expect from this demographic, the great majority of those lesions are going to be warts. And in fact, almost all of the protection was seen against warts because that's what occurs in this population. And that is the reason that the vaccine was approved by the ACIP for the prevention of warts. Even though we saw protection against persistent 16 and 18 infection, the disease endpoint is what counts. And since the disease that was seen was warts, that's what the approval was sought for and received. Now, what about anal infection and MSM? So this, I think, is also very exciting. So this is the efficacy against persistent anal infection in the per protocol population. Now, again, we're looking very specifically at anal disease and infection. And what we see is that we saw an overall reduction in the vaccine types of nearly 95%, and very good protection against all the HPV types, including 16 with a 94% reduction and 18 with a 100% reduction. And these were all very statistically significant, with the exception of the 11, which we didn't have enough numbers for. Again, disease is what counts here, and the thing that I find very encouraging is that when we looked at the combined endpoints for AIN and cancer related to the 4 vaccine types, we saw a statistically significant reduction of nearly 77% for those lesions. And that was true for warts, where we saw 100% prevention of anal warts, intraanal warts. And to me, since I'm primarily interested in cancer, I was particularly excited that we had nearly 75% reduction in AIN2 or worse. So this is the first demonstration that we can not only prevent warts, but also a potentially precancerous lesion. So just to summarize then, I believe that MSM are an unacceptably high risk of anal cancer, and we need to do something. Screening and treatment of high-grade disease, I think, from my personal opinion, is a reasonable thing to do in high-risk populations to reduce the risk of progression to cancer. We need more studies, but I think it is unethical to do nothing. And then I think perhaps the best news of all for the long-term issues of implementation notwithstanding is that we've now demonstrated that the vaccine that's so successful in women also has the potential to be successful at reducing cancer in MSM. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have 12 or 15 minutes for some questions and answers. Because of limited time, I'll ask this question to be succinct. The reply is succinct. Knowing that people will start to bail, I'll say now again the thanks to Merck for sponsoring this and the thanks to the American Social Health Association for organizing it in the persons of Lynn Barkley, Deborah Arundel, Fred Wyand, and Lisa Gilbert. Thank you. And questions, and we'll just pass the mic to the appropriate person. This is the first hand I saw. I suspect all three of the participants might have something to say about it. Joel, why don't you go first?
So the question is, our questioner is a school teacher and she's interested in potentially recommending HPV vaccination to her male students. She's concerned that their doctors may disagree, and so what do we think about that? Obviously, we are proponents of vaccination of men. I think we need to educate the medical profession as much as we need to educate patients. And you know, it's clear that it prevents warts, and in and of itself, that's a good thing. What we don't have proof yet for, but which Kevin alluded to, was the potential for herd immunity. So you will also be potentially protecting your female students. And the higher the proportion of women who are vaccinated, the less the herd immunity effect, but the numbers that Kevin showed you are still below that threshold, indicating that herd immunity might still be beneficial.
Others have comments?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think we know the vaccine is safe, we know it's effective, and the biggest issue is implementation and cost, so.
As I alluded to, there are certainly, I know others in the room aside from myself who are not especially happy that the ACIP decided not to make immunization in men a more assertive recommendation. I think if there's one lesson we've learned from hepatitis B experience and other immunizations, that without universality, you don't get it. And the fact is that even if you leave aside the warts and the herd protection of women issue, the fact is that two facts that you didn't mention in your data, but I understood were shown, Joel, is that whereas in women, people acquire the HPV vaccine types relatively gradually, so you'd like to start at age 11 or 12 before sexual debut. If you miss, you still have a pretty good window to get people who are still susceptible to one or more types. In the MSM, as I require, they very rapidly acquire three or four of those types within their first very early in their sexual experience. So it's probably even a higher priority in boys, those boys who are destined to become MSM, to get them immunized. And you're not going to capture them by any selective approach, obviously, in their pre-sexually active years. So I think there an argument can be made on those grounds very strongly on that basis, but perhaps not all will disagree. Kevin, why don't you make a comment on that, and then we'll take other questions.
Well, I'm not sure I have anything to add more than what's been said, but one of the things that was said at the ACIP meeting, which kind of blew me away since I know some 12 and 13-year-old boys, was to ask them if they thought they were going to be gay when they grew up. But that just totally floored me. So that would be the best way to be sure nobody gets the vaccine.
Hunter, just want to make one additional comment. Actually, I didn't have time to show you the naive data in the MSM, but the surprising thing to me was actually how few of them had lost the benefit of the vaccine even after this stage. Yeah, only about 30 or so percent had acquired one or more HPV type. Almost none had all four. So it isn't quite as dire as it sounds. Well, as we have two ID docs on, I'm sorry, how receptive have ID docs been in doing anal pap smears. And the answer is it's changing. You know, at first people thought it was pretty crazy, and but I think the gospel is spreading. We're doing trainings and we're selling out very quickly through the ASCCP. So I think the attitude has changed. No. So just to repeat the question, our questioner says that she works in Seattle. She's allowed to give the vaccine or recommend the vaccine if people request it, but not allowed to proactively offer it. Can we explain that? I said no.
Dr. Martin.
So the question is, why do we think there's more anal HPV than cervical HPV in women? My take on this is that the anus is a great reservoir. On a per-infection basis, you get less cancer than in the cervix, but it's a great place to hang out. And there are lots of ways to get there. In women, that T-zone is actually more externalized than it is in men. So the women may be even more susceptible than the men. Doesn't take a lot to go in there. You don't have to have receptive anal intercourse to do it. It could be shedding from the anterior genitals, could be fingers, toys. Our overall sense from the data is that anal HPV infection, anal intercourse is the most efficient way to get it, but by far not the only way.
The question is about HPV type distribution after the introduction of vaccination. So I think there are a couple of things about that. Both versions of the vaccine offer some modest cross protection because, again, thinking like a clinician, you know, there's the HPV 16 family and the HPV 18 family and all of its cousins. So there's a modest amount of cross protection for both versions of the vaccine. Their DNA viruses, and they don't have a huge genome, so they just don't change that fast. I think the data I saw at Eurogen was one mutation every 10,000 years or some unbelievable number of generations of HPV. So, and you know, we still have anal pap smears and cervical pap smears and ways to find those people. There is a surveillance project going on at the CDC, and I don't see anybody that I think would know about that, and if they want to rush up to the mic and you know about that data, please come forward.
I would summarize, don't make the mistake of assuming that what happens in bacterial ecology necessarily applies to viruses in terms of filling niches in that way. It may, and it's reasonable to do this surveillance, but most people in this field don't expect that that'll be as major a problem as it would be with a bacterial infection. Yes. Anybody?
I guess I have two comments. Yes, so the question is, wouldn't it be a good marketing strategy to not only talk about cervical cancer prevention in females, but also anal cancer prevention in females? I think we have to be a little careful about that for two reasons. One, although the data I think are very compelling in the men, they haven't been done in the women, and we tend to keep our messages very specific to where the studies have been done. And the other is, quite frankly, and maybe a little bit cynically, I don't think anal cancer gets people's juices flowing yet in the women's population.
I think I was being cynical in my question.
I think it's reasonable as a talking point to say this, the way that I put it, and you might see this in a Medscape news release coming out very soon, is that I told the reporter that I think women could be told that they may be getting a twofer, you know, because they're primarily getting vaccinated to prevent cervical disease, but in all likelihood, they'll also be protected against anal.
As you know, for all pharmaceutical projects, products in the U.S., the marketing programs are very much constrained by the FDA and what the studies can and cannot be extrapolated to show. So the bottom line is that the vaccine manufacturers simply are not able to, at least in an overt and public fashion, market against a protection that has not been documented to the FDA's satisfaction, and anal cancer in women is among those. Sue.
So that question is hard to, oh, okay. So are two doses going to be enough, if I can paraphrase your talk? So that was the question. Or an alternate schedule. So, I mean, that's a very active area of research as far as alternate schedules go, and there are some prospective randomized trials going on. But, you know, we don't have a correlate of immunity to tell whether people are still protected. As I said, as long as you want to follow people, there's still protection from the three shot. There's a little hint of that in the Merck, the quadrivalent vaccine trials, because, you know, we had some people who didn't come back for appointments like they're supposed to, surprisingly. So, but they still got vaccinated. You know, we still tried to follow them, but unfortunately, if you didn't show up for your second, third vaccine, you just tend to disappear from the protocol. So that's a pretty limited data set. I think some of that made it into the FDA labeling, though, might be the easiest way to find that.
Okay, one, we have to make this the last question so we can clear out and get to the next session. A quick answer and a quick response, please.
So what are the first line treatments for anal dysplasia? If there's small lesions, we've shown that trichloroacetic acid, topical, works in the anal canal just like in the EGLs. And then for more extensive disease, which is unfortunately rather common, we use, a wonderful, relatively new technique called infrared coagulation, an office-based procedure which internists like myself can do.
Thank you again to all three speakers. Thanks again to Asha and Merck.